Welcome to another episode of 35 West. I'm Richard Miles, Deputy Director of the Americas Program here at CSIS. Today we're going to be talking about human trafficking and specifically human trafficking in the country of Belize. I have today as my guest Victor Boutros, who is the founder of the Human Trafficking Institute. Welcome, Victor.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Victor, before we begin, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background, how did you come to be the founder of this organization?
So I worked for a number of years at the Justice Department as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division, which is responsible for, among other things, prosecuting human trafficking cases around the country. And in 2007, the Justice Department created a human trafficking prosecution unit, which was a unit of prosecutors that would focus full-time on trafficking enforcement around the U.S. And so I became a part of that unit and was part of that team that would go out and in partnership with federal agents and local law enforcement, as well as federal prosecutors, help conduct the investigation and take the cases all the way through investigation to indictment, through trial and sentencing. And as I was doing this work, I had an opportunity to take a step back and work on a book with a friend of mine, Gary Haugen, who leads an organization called International Justice Mission. And we had taught a course at the University of Chicago Law School, and Oxford Press allowed us to put together a book-length treatment of that book. It's called The Locust Effect, Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. And it was an opportunity for me to sort of take a step back from the boots-on-the-ground work that I'd been doing as a prosecutor and look at some of the larger trends globally that were emerging, and really saw that we'd seen a pretty significant transformation in the legislative landscape. More and more countries were passing laws against trafficking, and even some pretty significant progress in the political will to seek to enforce trafficking. But one of the challenges was that many of the police and prosecutors and judges, particularly in developing countries, were saying, we don't really have access to people who have done a lot of these cases before, and we'd really like to build our skill set to be able to do these specialized cases well. And we realized that's something where we can step in and potentially take a model that we'd helped successfully pilot at the Justice Department, had been a part of a successful pilot at the Justice Department, and begin to take that to countries that were serious about measurably improving their trafficking enforcement, but didn't have access to the right resources.
And what year are we talking about, Victor? When was this?
So I left in 2015, and my co-founder, John Richmond, who's also was a federal prosecutor for about a decade at the Justice Department as well in the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit, left in early 2016. And so we were full-time in spring 2016.
Thank you. That's obviously, you've got the background to do this. What I wanted to talk to you about this morning was, as you know, the State Department publishes an annual report, the Trafficking in Persons Report, since I think about 2001, right? And in the report, they divide up basically countries into various tiers, with Tier 3 being the worst of the worst. And on that list, of the 23 countries on that list, there are two countries in the Western Hemisphere, Belize and Venezuela. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the report itself, sort of what prompted Congress in 2000 to pass the legislation that made the report a requirement.
So I think there was a kind of a U.S. component and an international component to the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which was the law that was passed that helped create this office within the State Department and also gave U.S. prosecutors a new set of prosecutorial tools to go after traffickers after a Supreme Court case in the late 80s had made it very difficult to go after traffickers in the U.S. And so the international component, I think, was in part an effort to help drive political will to seek to improve awareness and enforcement of human trafficking within countries' borders. So the tier ranking was a way to help assess countries, how well they're sort of combating and fighting trafficking within their own borders. And if you received a Tier 3 grade, the lowest grade, there's three tiers, Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. And then they've later created an additional tier, Tier 2 watch list, which is sort of in between Tier 2 and Tier 3. And if you're at Tier 3, you're subject to certain kinds of economic sanctions, or you could potentially lose funding from from different multilateral bank sources. And so it helped create, I think, both a reputational cost and a potential financial cost for not taking trafficking enforcement seriously. So the flip side was, it was a way to say, hey, we'd like to see improvement, measurable improvement. And so in order to do that, it sort of forces, in a sense, countries to confront how they're doing and engage sort of with this issue in a different way. And so I think that was the early vision of why this would be created. The State Department was also offering tools to help support and resource the different challenges that countries might be experiencing. But in order for that to, for those resources to be used wisely and effectively, there needed to be some effort to assess where are we with the problem.
So Belize, for listeners who can't remember where Belize is or anything about it, pretty small country, used to be known as British Honduras. Tourism is kind of its thing, sandwiched in between the Caribbean, Mexico, and Guatemala. Also has one of the highest HIV/AIDS rates in Central America. It's not a wealthy country. It's about the size of Massachusetts, but it's only got a GDP of less than $3.1 billion. And to put that into context, according to the Forbes 400, Donald Trump is also worth $3.1 billion, and he's only number 248 on the list. So we're talking about a small country, not a lot of resources. Tourism is the main industry. How on earth does a country like Belize end up as tier three on the TIP report?
Well, the way that the tiers are created, it's really focusing on what kind of effort is the country making to oppose trafficking. So the Trafficking Victims Protection Act created a statutory set of minimum standards that they would like to see implemented. And countries that fully comply with those minimum standards receive a tier one rating. And then if you are making significant efforts to bring yourself into compliance but aren't yet in compliance, then you're going to be tier two. And if you're tier two watch list, it means that you are making significant efforts, but you also have either a very large number of victims of significant trafficking, or that your numbers are significantly increasing, or that you're not putting forward the data to show that you're making significant efforts, or that the determination that you have started making significant efforts is based on your commitment to undertake certain steps in the next year. And then if you're at tier three, it means that you're really not making significant efforts. And so I think part of the concern, and this has been something that congressional oversight has pushed over the years as well, is to really have some of the tier rankings look at the objective data of criminal justice metrics. What are the number of new investigations, the number of arrests, the number of convictions, what's the average length of sentence, looking at sort of standard criminal justice metrics so that there's some objective data on which the tier ranking is made. And I think that the data suggested that in 2016, Belize didn't have any new trafficking convictions at all. And I think there was just one in 2015 that resulted in a fine only, no jail time for the trafficker that was convicted. So I think part of the challenge there was a perception that Belize was not making efforts as significant as it might to actually address the trafficking challenges there.
So here's a country that has laws on its books, so that's not the problem, but doesn't appear to be in a hurry to enforce those laws, to put it mildly. So there are other organizations out there that focus on trafficking, and a lot of them have what folks call the name and shame model, where you basically hold the country up and say, look at what a bad job they're doing. Your model is different. It's somewhat similar to what International Justice Mission does, but it is distinct from them as well. If you could explain sort of how is it that you're different in addressing trafficking in Belize?
Yeah, so I think that very broadly speaking, you can sort of categorize anti-trafficking efforts into one of three main buckets. On the one hand, there are organizations that are trying to reduce the vulnerability of potential victims who are vulnerable to trafficking. And this could be done through awareness campaigns or through poverty alleviation efforts or education efforts, all of which are very important. Then there's another bucket, which is really focusing on how do we begin to care for those who are survivors of trafficking, who were trafficked but aren't anymore. And after that level of trauma, there's often a great need for shelter and counseling and vocational training and support, all also very, very important. But what we found as we would travel around the country and eventually more globally and meet with traffickers who often would plead guilty and have to walk through their business model in preparation for testifying against co-conspirators as a way to follow through with their plea, is that neither of those types of intervention really had very much impact at all on the trafficker's business model. From their perspective, there was such a large sea of vulnerable victims that it was sort of like a stocked pond with billions of fish. And from their perspective, I could just show up tomorrow with my same bait and my same rod, and at the end of the day, walk away with this, all the fish I want, with the same number of fish. So reducing the vulnerability of a couple of 100,000 fish in the pond is actually not going to change my business model at all. I'll still find all the victims I want. And on the other side, they felt like, well, once I'm done with them, I don't really care what happens to them. So there was a trafficker a couple of years ago who had pled guilty and asked where the sex trafficking victims were. And it said, you know, we actually like it when you spend resources on aftercare because we're done with them. I'm unlucky I got caught, but for others out there, they've already moved on to the next victim. So they're not making any less money when you clean up our mess, as he put it. And as a result, they are looking at this as a dollars and cents problem. It's an economic crime. They're trying to make money, and neither of those interventions has a very big impact on their business model. So one of our questions was, well, what does? What actually impacts their business model? And what we discovered is that in this trafficking landscape, you can actually begin to move upstream and stop trafficking at its source, at the trafficker level, and begin to increase the risk of the trafficker's business model through enforcement. Once traffickers perceive that, wait a second, you mean law enforcement could come in and actually seize my profits and take away my business, and I could lose my business, my family, my freedom, go to jail? Now it becomes too expensive for me to use force and threats and violence to coerce someone to work for me and pay them almost nothing. It's almost cheaper for me to either shift industries or shift into paying voluntary laborers a market wage to prevent them from going to a competitor. So we're focused on sort of that middle bucket of how do we actually move upstream and stop traffickers. And I think that's also a bucket that International Justice Mission has focused on. My partner, John, worked for International Justice Mission for a number of years in the helped build their anti-trafficking model in India before he was recruited to the Justice Department to join the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit. And he did an amazing job of building this team that he would train of International Justice Mission investigators and lawyers who would go out and find cases and then try and move the rusty wheel of public justice in some cases forward by taking away all the excuses for inaction. So they would bring these cases together, and if the police said, well, we don't know where the victim is, and so here's the address. Well, we don't know really that this person committed a crime. Well, here's the evidence. Here's the admission on an undercover camera that they committed this crime, and so on. And they found that they could actually get that wheel to turn through a lot of persistence and a lot of effort and a lot of dedication. And so they're sort of trying to turn that wheel, in a sense, from the outside. And what we want to do is bring a complementary model where we're working on turning that wheel from the inside, of actually building a relationship with the government that allows us to essentially do three things: to go in and help them build and vet specialized enforcement units, police and prosecutors, fast-track courts, judges who are moving those cases through, so that you have one segment of the criminal justice pipeline that's efficiently pushing cases through. And then we will take cohorts from that specialized unit who are now focused on human trafficking enforcement as their primary task, and shifting them, putting them through an academy where they're sort of, we're walking through, here's some of the strategies that we've seen be effective in finding more cases and conducting effective undercover operations and putting together a raid plan and doing a trauma-informed victim interview. Here's a victim-centered approach to the actual prosecution and trialing of the case. And then we pair them up with other prosecutors or investigators who've done this work before, who are embedded and actually go and office with them and begin to work with them day in and day out on their cases. And we saw a similar model produce really significant change here in the U.S. And there were, I think, countries who were serious about measurably improving their trafficking enforcement but didn't have access to that model in their country.
And have these activities already started in Belize, or do you have a sort of an agreement to begin, or what's the status?
Yeah, so we have spent quite a bit of time this past year in Belize building those relationships and meeting with a number of the senior leaders there, a number of the cabinet-level ministers there. And as you noted, they actually have a pretty good law. The law is not the problem. And there was a delegation of terrific leaders who came from Belize to D.C. and participated in a two-day delegation on human trafficking. And there were a couple of cabinet-level officials there, and the head of the Women's Commission and the chief magistrate judge. I think the number two from the National Police was there, and the ambassador. So really strong team of leaders from Belize that came up and spent some time talking through some different strategies and opportunities. And out of that, the Belizean cabinet has approved recommendations that were made by that delegation team to the cabinet of Belize. And so now those recommendations are starting to be disseminated, and there's now, we understand, a directive from the cabinet for Belize to build a specialized investigative unit. In fact, we have team members on the ground this week in Belize who are helping with a forensic interview training that's being done for some law enforcement there, and Department of Homeland Security is also partnering with us in that effort, and entered into an agreement with the Chief Justice of Belize, and he's interested in some training of Belizean judges, which will take place in December. So we're excited about that. And there's now a designated judge who's going to be the judge who will be fast-tracking these cases. So we've been really encouraged by the really practical and proactive steps that Belize is taking.
So it sounds like there's a very significant and impressive, I have to say, political commitment. But obviously this is going to probably take a while to play out in the statistics. So we might not see a change in the tip report for, what, another year or two, best case scenario, or could it be faster than that?
I think that's right. I think it is going to take time for these commitments to actually come down into the numbers where you can see a change in the number of investigations and arrests and convictions where there's sort of measurable progress in that space. But I do think if Belize continues to follow through with the commitments that it's making, and it will be an accelerated timeline, but I think in the next 1 to 2 years, I think it really could actually come off that tier three list, which it's now been on for 3 years, which would be, I think, a tremendous testament to the leadership of Belize in focusing on this problem and really moving it forward. And I think that could have a potentially domino effect on other countries that are similarly situated, that are interested in measurably improving their trafficking enforcement and saying, here's a successful model of a country that took a leadership role in beginning to really turn that around.
Has your institute even tried in Venezuela, given the sort of political chaos there? Is that a bridge too far?
We have not. So our model is really we're really trying to go kind of a mile deep and not too wide, rather than an inch deep and a mile wide. And so we're really focusing right now on a couple of countries where we're entering into deeper long term partnerships, because it takes, as you can imagine, a longer time to really build effective, self-sustaining enforcement units that are able to handle normal attrition and hit performance benchmarks. And so we're partnering also with Uganda, which has been a terrific partner in the last year as we've assessed sort of another opportunity. So we're really trying right now to build some data and look at what happens when you bring this model to two very different countries and very different parts of the world that are culturally very distinct, but who have leaders that are interested and serious about measurably improving trafficking enforcement. And could they actually become the kind of leaders that help precipitate a larger domino effect in other countries where now this model really begins to spread? And hopefully people don't have to spend years of their life undergoing this terrible trauma of trafficking or spend years trying to recover from that trauma. They're spared from that in the first place.
Victor, one final question. Is there anything you think that U.S. policymakers could or should be doing differently, as apart from the TIP report, that would help combat trafficking in persons?
You know, I think that there's been some discussion and interest in seeing the model that was piloted. It's called the ACT Team model, the Anti-Trafficking Coordination Teams, that was piloted while John and I were still at the Justice Department. It's now expanding to its next set of districts, and I think as that model continues to grow, we'll see more and more progress on the domestic front. Internationally, there's been some interest in trying to build a global fund to begin to decimate slavery. There are some experts who perceive trafficking today as occupying a role that HIV played 15 years ago. 15 years ago, you just couldn't operate in the developing world without being impacted by HIV. And on the heels of that, there was a global fund that was raised to begin to identify what are the interventions where the data is demonstrating that it's really working, and can we scale those up? And there's been some really encouraging progress made on the HIV front. Still much to do, but really significant tangible progress. And I think the hope is that we can do something similar with trafficking, that trafficking has become this bottleneck that in a sense chokes out the efficacy of other really important public health and poverty alleviation efforts that are being focused on in developing countries, where if you've got these smart programs, but the people who are the intended beneficiaries are literally walled off from them by a brothel wall or by a slave compound, then that's a tragedy that we can fix. And if we can scale up programs that are stopping traffickers and that are actually beginning to measurably decimate trafficking in different parts of the world, we can wedge open that bottleneck and allow those intended beneficiaries to receive the bandwidth that's already there from so many other efforts that we're helping support and fund. And so encourage, we'll see what happens with this fund. I think the goal is to raise a $1.5 billion fund that is co-funded by the U.S. and by other partner governments that participate, and also by the private sector, and that really has a strategic focus on being able to scale what's demonstrated to measurably reduce trafficking. So I would love to see that fund really strategically managed and some strategic focus from the leadership there, and that fund grow, because I think that is probably what it will take to see trafficking decimated on a large scale.
Well, Victor, thank you very much. I look forward to having you on again in a year or two, and you have tell me that Belize is no longer tier three. One, it'll mean my podcast is still alive, and two, it'll mean that obviously you had an impact, which you already are having. So thank you very much for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you, Richard. I really love what you guys are doing, and it's a privilege to get to do this together.
Thanks. Thank you for tuning in again to another episode of 35 West. If I could ask just one favor, if you're listening to this on iTunes, if you'd please leave a review and rate us. It helps us out a lot. If you don't like us, just forget what I just said. Anyway, looking forward to another edition of 35 West next week.